Welcome to A Skeptic's Guide to Conspiracy, a bi-weekly podcast dedicated to the examination of conspiracy theory, conspiracy fact, and those who promote these theories. I will be your host, Mike Bowler, as I examine a conspiracy theory, applying critical thinking and skepticism to better understand and seek out the truth behind conspiracy theories. So for this episode, I will be covering a few listener requests on a couple of conspiracies, non-conspiracy type stuff that has popped up over probably the past 6 months or so, and try to answer a few of these actually quite interesting questions. So I'll be covering the Max Headroom incident, Jade Helm 15, and the Walmart closings conspiracy, Carol Quigley's Tragedy and Hope. So let's get started. First, we have I'm going to talk about the Max Headroom incident. Now, this is actually a signal intrusion by a hacker on November 22nd, 1987, in Chicago, where somebody somehow was able to hijack a television signal and put out some video. It was a live video of him in a Max Headroom mask. Max Headroom was a fairly popular pop culture figure of the late 80s, where it was kind of a cyberpunk type character that apparently, as the story goes, he had found information on some type of nefarious dealings at a television station, and was a newscaster. Of course, his name was Edison Carter. And while trying to escape from the bad guys, he ran into a parking garage, and the cross plank that hit. Was the last thing he saw was the word Max Headroom 10 feet or something like that. And of course the scientist was able to save his body and downloaded his mind into a computer, which kind of took over and became this character that would pop up on televisions as Max Headroom. And this intrusion tried to mimic as much of the Max Headroom persona as possible. And, of course, not terribly professional, but it was a pretty good rendition of a Max Headroom character. Of course, then began to spout kind of somewhat political-related stuff. Now, there was a first attempt during the 9 o'clock news on Channel 9 in Chicago. This was WGN. Before it became a superstation. And when the incursion began, engineers at the station realized that something was going wrong. They were able to switch to an alternate frequency to the transmitter and was able to block the intrusion. So for 15 seconds, there was a temporary loss of signal, and the hacker had control for just under 15 minutes, but was able to be shut down right away. But later that night, at around 11:15 p.m., this is all Central Time, the hacker then went after the WTTW Channel 11 signal. Channel 11 is the public broadcasting service station in Chicago. And at the time was playing a Doctor Who episode when he was able to break in. The thing is, with WTTW, they didn't have an alternate frequency that they could switch over to, so the hacker basically took control of the station for about 15 minutes And he was able to, or was able to speak, a number of, various, attacks, not necessarily political, attacking, the New Coke, a lot of, but during the, during this, there was a lot of laughing, a lot of giggling, and then out would come some stuff like catch the wave, holding a Pepsi can. Then he tossed the can down, leaning toward the camera to give the finger, wearing a rubber extension over his middle finger as though it was hard to see the gesture. Then retrieving the Pepsi can and saying, "Your love is fading," before removing the rubber extension and began humming started humming the theme song to Clutch Cargo. Again, if you're not familiar with, this was a cartoon fairly popular in the 60s. Actually, if you were in Chicago, you probably saw it on daytime television, usually during many of the kids' programs that were broadcast from WGN. He would also go attack the Tribune Company. He held up a glove and says, "My brother's wearing the one," and he put the glove on, "but it's dirty. It's like you got blood stains on it," and then threw the glove down in disgust. Then there was where he dropped his pants, and someone else on the show began to spank him. And then that's the extent of the intrusion. And to date, no one's come forward. No one's been able to determine who did this, what reasons he did it. Pretty much, probably it's going to be a mystery for a good long time unless the person or persons involved will come forward. There was a Reddit post from a person who claims to know the people involved with this. Unfortunately, to give it credibility, it's very hard because all this is anonymous. There was no reference to where they were, no backing information to the claims that this person was making, that he actually knew this person or persons. So again, we're really stuck with not knowing what really happened. It's the best we can tell. It was probably some electronics geek. Now this is not, I use the term hackers. That's what he did. He hacked into the signal. Now this will be the signal from the studio to the transmitter. The WTGW and the WGN studios are on the north side of Chicago, and they would use a microwave link to talk to their transmitters. WGN has their transmitters on the top of the John Hancock Center, whereas WTGW operated a transmitter on top of the Sears Tower. This would mean that the signal intrusion had to occur somewhere between the north side of Chicago and the downtown or loop area of Chicago. And, of course, this person would have to have had television-grade transmitting equipment, maybe not necessarily a decent camera, which from looking at the videos that are on YouTube, that the video cameras may not have been as well tuned to a television signal. There's a lot of side static and so on. So they probably were using commercial grade or a consumer grade type cameras to put a signal out. But they did know enough how to get the signal to the transmitters. Being able to, again, you have to have enough power to overpower the studio. And then, again, that was part of the problem why WTW didn't pull themselves off or shut down or what they were trying to do is boost their signal to override their signal. But they were afraid they would damage some equipment, which turned out they wouldn't have. But after the event, it was realized that these signals were vulnerable. So WTGW did upgrade their systems. WGN also upgraded their systems. The FBI was involved with some investigations. They weren't able to determine anything other than it was probably done in a garage somewhere, possibly a storage unit. But other than that, they have no clue to who did this and how they were able to do it. And this kind of there really isn't a conspiracy here. This is really just I'm going to say a couple kids who trying to have some fun. And this is usually the 9 out of 10 hackers. That's what they were doing. I mean, other than. I don't think they were actually out to do any real damage or steal anything. Or, I mean, even though this signals was somewhat political, there wasn't. It was quite very childish, very lowbrow. But it did catch the. It does have the interest of the FBI, and even to this day, there is concerns about hackers breaking into television signals. There was a much earlier incident called the Captain Midnight, where a satellite link was compromised and a message put out on HBO channels protesting the HBO's decision to raise their price to $12. It turned out it was done within the system. And the FBI learned that an accountant had overheard, Captain Midnight signal intrusion happened on April 27, 1986. An electrical engineer and business owner, John R. McDougall, using a pseudonym Captain Midnight, jammed HBO's satellite signal to broadcast a message protesting the rates for satellite dish owners on April 27, 1986 at 12:32 a.m. Eastern Time. McDougall was overseeing the uplink for the movie Pee-wee's Big Adventure as part of the evening's programming for the now-defunct pay-per-view network People's Choice, which used Central Florida's teleport facilities. At the end of his shift, he swung the dish back into its original position, which aimed it at the location of Galaxy One, the satellite that carried HBO. As protests against the introduction of high fees and scrambling equipment, he transmitted a signal onto the satellite that for 4.5 minutes overrode HBO's telecast of the movie The Falcon and Snowman, which had begun 2 minutes earlier. The text message that appeared on the screens of HBO subscribers across the eastern half of the country read, "Good evening, HBO, from Captain Midnight, $12.95 a month, no way. Showtime movie channel, beware." Hughes Communications threatened to shut down HBO satellite signal or alter the satellite's course, with executives believing the hacker was a domestic terrorist. HBO's engineer tried to regain control by increasing the uplink transmission power from 125 to 2,000 watts. This was unsuccessful, and it feared that a further power increase would damage the satellite. And, of course, the FBI was called in and eventually was able to determine McDougall was the culprit and he would be prosecuted. He plea bargained for a $5,000 fine and was placed on probation for 1 year. McDougall chose the name Captain Midnight from a movie he had recently seen on air live with Captain Midnight. This is not associated with the popular Captain Midnight radio show of the 1940s. So, again, other than the fact that this is it seems to be being viewed by the FBI as a potential domestic terrorist ploy. Though in my past shows, it seems that the FBI they tend to react in strange ways. Whether this is still true or not, it's unclear. But of course, now everything being more digital, that the ability to hijack a satellite is greatly reduced, and certainly the data links between transmitter and studio is probably a lot more robust and secure than the analog microwave that they were probably using in the 80s. So, I mean, the only takeaway I can take from this particular incident is that there's, and this is mostly pertaining to the Max Headroom incident, that there isn't a lot of information. There's been people, there was this Reddit post that, again, a lot of anonymous, no details about location, if they used any particular type of equipment, that type of thing to really give it any credibility. And this is something that I try to look for when I look at a story. How much of it is anonymous? How much of the story is where the information is just too vague to draw any real conclusions? You know, and kind of as a side note, I actually got my hands on the AP's style book, which also deals with anonymous sources. And certainly I wanted to get kind of a better feel for when reporting the news, reporting a story, you know, how important at least give me a guideline on what is acceptable and how anonymous can the sources be? How do you deal with an anonymous source? The AP apparently is supposed to be, if you're an AP reporter, you're supposed to be finding secondary sources to back up the anonymous source if possible. If the anonymous source is making a claim, there should be some sort of documentation in other areas to support that claim. And I have not found anything for this particular incident, though there is some certain highly circumstantial out of the TWA 800 story that I did, where there was a white paper done on domestic terrorism, which is basically had the kind of the layout of potential terrorist attacks within the United States, bombing of buildings, shooting down of aircraft, flying aircraft into buildings. And the FBI was in possession of this in the 1980s. Whether this played into anything with this particular case, I don't have a connection, so it's not as reliable as I would like it to be. So with that said, I'd like to slide into Jade Helm 15 and the Walmart closings. Now, Jade Helm 15 is a military operation. It's a training mission that will involve U.S. Army Special Operations Command, USASOC, with other U.S. Armed Forces units in a multi-state exercise that includes Texas, Arizona, New Mexico, Utah, and Colorado. The USASOC claimed the size and scope of Jade Helm sets this one apart from previous training exercises. Some parts of the operation details have been disclosed, including the fact that there will be 1,200 troops participating, and according to CNN, mainly Army Green Berets, but a small group of Navy SEALs and Air Force Special Operations troops, as well as conventional Army infantry. Lieutenant Colonel Mark Lasoria, at an information session for residents in Bastrop, Texas, said the realistic military training helps soldiers adapt to unfamiliar terrain. In that location, 60 soldiers will take part, including the presence of two Humvee vehicles and a water buffalo water tank. Private land offered by residents would be used for the exercise, though he noted they would not be paid for the land or receive a tax break of any kind. Lasoria also claims $150,000 in revenue would be brought in the area because of food, fuel, and shopping. And what seems to have triggered this conspiracy theory, and this is coming straight from Alex Jones and his interpretation, comes from a map that was used to describe the operation. This map divides the region into red states and blue states, with the red states of Utah and Texas labeled as hostile, blue states California, Nevada, and Colorado as permissive. The actual disposition of each of these states was to label Texas and Utah as hostiles, California and Arizona as friendly, and then the other states would be a mix of moderately hostile, moderately permissive. And when I did further research into it, they chose these states because also apparently there's supposed to be some operations in Florida and in Louisiana and Alabama, Mississippi. They chose these areas to represent the current situation that these soldiers will be fighting in, desert, semi-arid, or in some cases somewhat tropical, like in Florida. And these would be exercises that they would be undertaking to conduct operations outside the United States. Unfortunately, with guys like Alex Jones, who thinks everything is a conspiracy, he is convinced that Jade Helm, or Jade Helm 15, is a similar operation to Rex 84. Now, Rex 84 is Readiness Exercise 1984, which was a similar type operation where the military would, along with civilian contacts, mostly police and emergency management teams, as an exercise in cooperation between these different units, basic training for special operations in different climates. And, of course, with Rex 84 was centered on domestic disturbances, whereas Rex 82, 79, 85, 88 also had the same components. But for some reason, 84 seems to be their favorite target, and now Jade Helm is now a similar type target. When I looked up the U.S. Army Special Operations Command website and looked under training, this particular group conducts 15 operations a year, training operations to prepare their soldiers for various tasks that they would be performing in the real world. And anybody who I would almost bet that if you were in the military, 2/3 of your time while you were there was conducting some form of training, whether it was classroom, field training, special training, coordination trainings, weapons trainings, interdepartmental trainings. There's all these trainings and missions and operations and exercises that go on. It's amazing. I mean, it's amazing to me. I was never in the military, but when I hear the stories about various training operations, my brothers both served in the Air Force. One has been in the Persian Gulf quite a bit. He's also been to Korea and Germany. And a lot of the stuff was training, going on alerts, conductor operations, setting. He operated a kitchen, and he would set up field kitchens. He did that in Desert Storm. All this is in preparation for the real thing. So, from what I've been reading, what I've been seeing, what was coming from the official statements, this is nothing. Jade Helm is nothing more than just another training mission. These are going to be guys that are going to be out on government land, on government reservations, doing real training. Whereas on occasion they would be out in smaller towns, coordinating with local officials, conducting training operations along that lines. Nothing nefarious. Nothing out of the ordinary. But of course, with Alex Jones, everything is all part of a master plan to impose the police state and take away all our civil liberties and line us up into FEMA camps. This is where the Walmart closings kind of fit in here. Now, this is actually a totally different story. The only reason why it gets linked is this FEMA connection, but I'll get into that here in a little bit, because what apparently happened with Walmart, they decided to close 5 stores across the United States. They closed one in California, the Pico Rivera store, along with 2 in Texas, 1 in Florida, and 1 in Oklahoma. And they called it the claim has been from Walmart has been a plumbing issue. And no one's buying it, basically. Pico Rivera was very active in trying to get better pay for Walmart workers. They were probably about one of the most active stores. The problem is the other stores weren't. So closing 5 stores for plumbing issues is, trying to use that as subterfuge to close 1 store. If these stores were making money, Walmart would not be closing these stores. So my personal opinion is these stores probably weren't making money, or there were some other issues. It could be plumbing, but closing them for 6 months, that's very, very suspicious to me. I mean, I will actually admit to that, because that's what many of the conspiracy people are saying. I suspect that these stores weren't making money, or something was wrong with these stores, perhaps. I don't really want to speculate, but there's something wrong, but it wasn't plumbing with these stores. But I don't think it was to give these stores over to FEMA to use them as introductory camps and food storage camps to when the Army under Jade Helm started arresting people, locking them up in FEMA or into these old Walmarts. Again, that is totally ridiculous. Totally ridiculous connection. So it's again trying to understand this Walmart thing. I find no evidence that these are stores that are having plumbing problems. In order for them to do plumbing work or reworking plumbing, they would need to have applied for permits to do, because these would have to be inspected by city inspectors. So it would be, since apparently none of, at least at this time, and again, this is still kind of a new conspiracy, so there may not be a lot of information on it. I haven't yet found anything, but as of this recording, I have not heard of any of these stores applying for building permits. It's possible that these stores didn't meet certain codes and we're in the process or going to be remodeled. Maybe they are in the process of being remodeled and realizing that these codes were not followed correctly. They may have already gotten into trouble with these stores. Now, we understand how Walmart store is built. These are all cookie cutter buildings. An architect it's one design and they just spread it, they just reuse it over and over again. Everything is a standard layout, the standard materials. Every store that was built would have the same suppliers, same builders, or same building materials. It should have been built to same construction specifications. Now, it's possible that these stores weren't or didn't meet certain specifications because the contractor skimped or whatever. That's quite possible. And if they did skimp and got into, or had bribed, this is more speculation. I'm sorry. But if these builders fudged something here or there, or maybe conducted a payoff in some form, it's quite possible they would have to close these stores and spend 6 months reworking all the issues. Unfortunately, there's no evidence of this, so please don't take this as anything definitive. Again, there's nothing out there saying that there was any improprieties anywhere. There's nothing saying that there was anything with the buildings themselves. Again, there's a lot of questions here. the only store that really does raise a little few red flags is the Pico Rivera store, where this was a store that many of the employees had been working to try to get higher minimum wages for Walmart workers. This may be a retaliatory, maybe not. No, it's very hard to find out if anyone would admit to that. I think this, again, will be one of those mysteries that until somebody blows the whistle on, we may never know why these stores actually closed. But they were not closed because of Jade Helm. So with that said, let's talk a little bit about Carol Quigley and his book, Tragedy and Hope. Now, I'm still reading this book. This is one of those books that I really need to read, because through my research, in every one of these conspiracies and people who promote conspiracies, they seem to love to quote Carol Quigley. They also like to quote Noam Chomsky. And it's important for me to understand these guys. And apparently these are what I would call these would be like the top of the top of philosophy, conspiracy philosophy. Not necessarily that I'm not claiming that Chomsky or Quigley are conspiracy people, but they are, many of their ideas play well to the conspiracy mindset. Now, again, I'm only into the first few chapters of Tragedy and Hope, and I'm already seeing some interesting conspiracy basis. Now, in these first few chapters, I've noticed that Quigley is actually an old school historian. He seems to be more classical as opposed to more postmodern. He is very big on classifying periods of time, identifying rises and falls in civilizations, things like that. And it's very Eurocentric in his thinking. Since this book was written in the 1950s, it was certainly Anglocentric also. So this is the definite problem with, at least in modern times, that Quigley may already be in a dated mindset. He doesn't necessarily, he only seems to acknowledge European accomplishments. Anything outside of Europe or United States seems to be non-existent. And again, that fits well with what was known historically at the time. Egypt was still fairly unknown. Sumeria, Babylonia, most of the Fertile Crescent civilizations, very little information was known about them. The Central American and South American cultures and civilizations weren't even really believed to be a civilization. And under the old classical view, a civilization had to have had math, writing, laws, monumental structures, etc. Whereas today, we have a much looser definition of civilizations. They don't necessarily have to have a written language. They don't necessarily have to have a mathematics. They don't necessarily have to have art. But they definitely monumental construction, or definitely much more robust construction techniques. That's why now we even view some of the African discoveries as potential civilizations, those in Central Africa outside of Egypt. So, yeah, Quigley seems already quite dated, and he does seem to, but he does make a very strong point about elitism. That there's an elite that controls, of course, in his mind, they control everything. Whereas the reality is, elites apparently, I guess, in the current sociological understandings that there's always been elites, there's always been people with money, with power, who have been able to affect people underneath them. The elites are the ones that drive luxury goods and so on. And in turn, the acquisition of these luxury goods have trickled down to middle class or lower class people. The idea that Quigley keeps putting forward is that these elites actually run the world. They allow governments to form, and they manipulate those governments to meet their needs. There's not probably some truth to that. I mean, certainly we've seen a lot of money being spent within our own elections from people with wealth. Again, I point back to the Koch brothers and their pumping of dollars into political candidates, political action groups in opposition to regulation and climate change. This is not anything new, nothing out of the ordinary. Texas Oil had pumped a lot of money into Lyndon Johnson's campaigns as a senator and then as president. Nixon received a lot of Texas Oil money. Franklin Roosevelt received a lot of Texas Oil money. So it's, again, I just finished reading a book on Texas Oil, so that's going to be something coming up here in future, a future show. So as soon as I know more about Quigley, I'll probably do a kind of a follow-up, or hopefully I should do a follow-up on what I find out. I think I'm hoping that at least from an intellectual standpoint, he does make a lot of sense. I think, though, that the interesting thing about Quigley and Chomsky, especially Quigley, he's been quoted as the good guy and bad guy. It's really funny. When Bill Clinton was president of the United States, Quigley was a bad guy because Clinton during an interview, claimed that Quigley was a mentor to him. Well, every Republican who hated Clinton's guts decided that Quigley was a bad guy. Today, he's viewed probably more as a good guy because he points out this elite trying to control the world through the Bilderbergs, the Council for Relations. But according to conspiracy people today, Quigley is a good guy. He's been he was the one who apparently exposes the Bilderbergs, the Council on Foreign Relations, the Rothschilds, and so on as being power brokers and running the world. So it's funny how Quigley is this. He's both the good guy and bad guy. I need to find out more. So that's, I'm going to keep reading his Tragedy and Hope and hopefully gain a little bit of a better handle on what he wrote about and what he believed. Now, I have no real news for this episode other than I'm still trying to deal with my current work situation. It's been pretty intense there at the office. I'm finding myself spending more time there than I can with doing research for the future shows and such. So I'm still hoping to try to stick to my 2-week schedule, but it's starting to look like at least 4 to 6 weeks of getting a show out. So please hang in there. Hopefully I can get back on schedule here pretty quick. I did want to do a show. It was a listener-inspired show on the poisoning of Americans during the Prohibition period. It's turning out to be a really interesting subject, and I would like to do a little bit more research on that before presenting that information. So hopefully I can have that out within a fairly quick. And of course I do have a couple emails to other listeners. So, hang in there. I'll have those out as soon as I can. And in, one other announcement is that I've been a panelist on the Unseen podcast, which is a kind of a panel discussion on various, science topics. I was on one with the Faster Than Light travel question and one on the current efforts to explore the solar system using the various satellites, telescopes, robotic landers, and the question of why not having humans actually land on sending up humans to Mars, so on. And it was really, really nice. They're really nice discussions. So I would highly recommend you checking it out. I'll leave links in my show notes and on my webpage where you could find the Unseen Podcast. And I'll have links to the podcast. Plus, I'll see if I can put links to the shows that I've been on, so you can listen to me talk about science a little bit. And other than that, thank you, and we'll talk to you soon. Now, I have no real news for this episode, other than I'm still trying to deal with my current work situation. It's been pretty intense there at the office. I'm finding myself spending more time there than I can with doing research for the future shows and such. So I'm still hoping to try to stick to my 2-week schedule, but it's starting to look like at least 4 to 6 weeks of getting a show out. So please hang in there. Hopefully I can get back on schedule here pretty quick. I did want to do a show. It was a listener-inspired show on the poisoning of Americans during the Prohibition period. It's turning out to be a real interesting subject, and I would like to do a little bit more research on that before presenting that information. So hopefully I can have that out within a fairly quick. And of course I do have a couple emails to other listeners, so hang in there. I'll have those out in as soon as I can. And in one other announcement is that I've been a panelist on the Unseen Podcast, which is a kind of a panel discussion on various science topics. I was on one with the faster than light travel question and one on the current efforts to explore the solar system using the various satellites, telescopes, robotic landers, and the question of why not having humans actually land on sending up humans to Mars, so on. And it was really, really nice. They're really nice discussions. So I would highly recommend you checking it out. I'll leave links in my show notes and on my webpage where you could find the Unseen Podcast, and I'll have links to the podcast. Plus, I'll see if I can put links to the shows that I've been on, so you can listen to me talk about science a little bit. And other than that, thank you, and we'll talk to you soon. Thank you for listening to A Skeptic's Guide to Conspiracy. You can find my show notes and links to research material at mikebohler.com. That's MikeBohler.com. Feel free to leave me feedback at feedback@mikebohler.com. If there's a conspiracy you're interested in or wish to contribute more information to this or previous topics, feel free to send that to research@mikebohler.com. A Skeptic's Guide to Conspiracy is a proud member of the Dumbass Media Network. Be sure to check out other great podcasts at dumbassmedia.info. Intro music is Unchained Zarina from danosongs.com. Thank you for listening, and we will see you next time. Thank you. Good night.